Hey everybody, welcome back to a brand new episode of Artsy Fartsy Immigrants. I have a very special guest in store for you today. Chad Kulchin. I'm so sorry, Chad, if I'm saying that incorrectly. You told me on the show it sounds like a C-H, but it's spelled K-U-L-T-G-E-N. Kulchin. I would say Kultgen. Kulchin. Is a highly esteemed American novelist, journalist, podcaster. He sat down with me for a nice, lengthy, fun chat. You know, he is the star, the creator of a podcast that I find very riveting, entertaining, and important called The Necessary Conversation that we get into. He is also, for those who are just itching to know his information, he's had works published in the Huffington Post, you know, Maxim, Penthouse, the New York Times, of course. He wrote also the 2013 Steve Carell film, The Incredible Burt Wonderstone, and the 2014 film Men, Women, and Children, based off the book that he wrote, starring Adam Sandler and I think Jennifer Garner and more. He also co-stars in a very successful podcast with one of my all-time comedy heroes from Mad TV, Will Sasso. The podcast is called Dudesy. So by all means, please sit back, relax, have fun. This is Chad Kulchin of The Necessary Conversation and Dudesy and the movies and the Hollywood and the fun. Let's jump right into it. No, perfect. Man, how do you, by the way, how do you pronounce your last name?
Kulchin.
Kulchin, like a C-H sound.
Yeah, at least okay. This is what my parents tell me.
Man, I've watched so many videos, particularly so many episodes of The Necessary Conversation, and the way your dad talks, man, is fascinating. It's really fascinating. This is actually, like, that's why I really wanted to talk with you. And we can actually just jump into everything, but like, you know, of course I've, I didn't know as much about your, experience as an author and a screenwriter. We're going to get into that. If you're down, I'd love to.
Yeah, of course.
But I knew you as like Will Sasso's co-host from Dudesy.
Sure.
I'm an enormous Will Sasso obsessive.
But okay.
I'm really into, I love Will. He's insane. I mean, he is insane.
Yeah, he's great.
But he's
one of my best friends of all time.
Dude, and it's so funny because I was watching a lot of Dudesy simply because I was like, oh, you know, Will Sasso, like, you know, when I think we have some years between us, and when Mad TV was like prime, I was obsessed with Ike Barinholtz, you know, Keegan-Michael Key, Jordan Peele,
sure,
and Will Sasso. More or less. Yeah. That was like the era, like, I think just before it, you know, more or less ended. Mm-hmm. And I was really crazy about Will Sasso. Like his, what's the, oh man, what's the impression he does? The singer.
Kenny Rogers.
Kenny Rogers. Yeah, thank you. Yeah. His Kenny Rogers and his Steven Seagal are just.
All of his impersonations, they always make me laugh. Always. And it's like to have a friend like that, that's just like. I mean, to me, he's one of the funniest people on planet Earth, and I love all of his impersonations. Like, they never get old to me. And to have that person then become your very good friend, it's like you're just, whenever you hang out, you're getting a little show that's just for you. Because, like, that, who he was on Dudesy, doing, like, incessant Schwarzeneggers and Hulk Hogan's and stuff, that's literally who he is. You know, that's what you're getting if you're just hanging out with him. That's happening pretty much all the time.
And I hate that I forgot the name of the real guy, but the guy who's down in the Baja.
Oh, Jesse Ventura.
Jesse Ventura, yes.
Minnesota for some years.
Will Sasso is like the only guy who can do an impression clearly too long, but it becomes funny again because it's too long.
Absolutely, yeah. He's great.
But I, yeah, like I was saying, I had watched plenty of Dudesy, and then for some reason, I don't know why, maybe it was just the camera angle, maybe it was because the context was so incredibly different, but when I started following The Necessary Conversation, your channel where you speak with your family, I didn't connect the dots instinctively that that's you.
Yeah, it's me. It's the same guy.
Have you had any messages from people saying that they? I mean, maybe I'm the lone wolf here, but have you had messages from people being like, the dudesy guy is talking to his, you know, QAnon alt-right parents?
You know, I do like. I've done a bunch of weird creative shit that may seem disparate to some people, but obviously the thread that ties them together is me, I suppose. And so some people have kind of followed me through everything I've done, from my first books to movies and TV shows to I was on 10-minute podcast for a minute with Will and Tommy Blacha back in the day. And then Will and I branched off into Dudesy. I do another podcast with a friend of mine named Lizzie Pace, where we talk about The Bachelor primarily, but now Love Island as a professional sport. And I've kind of taken what we developed basically like a system of how you can win that game of Bachelor. And so we went through and we watched every season of Bachelor from season 1 to season 25 at the time on 2x speed, every episode, kind of meticulously recording every play that was made, all the tears, roses, kisses, whatever. And we built like a mathematical system about how you can play that game and win it, wrote a book about that, and I started to train people to infiltrate that system, and they've done well. They've reached very high levels of success in that game. So now I'm starting to do that with Love Island as well. But people have followed me from that podcast, and then Dudesy, and now Necessary Conversation. And there are some people who like kind of watch it all or read it all or however you want to do it. I make music too. Some people are into that. But yeah, every once in a while, I'll get somebody who like doesn't know about the other things or knows about one of the other things, but primarily they're following this or that or whatever. But I always like that type of thing when people do realize like, oh, wait a minute. Was this the guy who got sued by George Carlin's daughter?
I was going to ask about
that. AI stand-up special. It's like, yes, that's me. It's the same guy.
What would you say? I mean, I'm guessing right now there's a lot of heat on the Necessary Conversation, but like what is the most frequently, what are you most frequently approached about, like in terms of the career paths you've taken over the years?
You mean just people walking up to me on the street?
Or, you know, messages, DMs, emails, people being like, yo, I loved, you know, XYZ. From Burt Wonderstone to Necessary Conversation or Men, Women, Children.
I think probably, maybe you're right that it's just because it's so recent, but Necessary Conversation gets like a ton of DMs and emails and all that kind of stuff.
Man.
I would probably say it's that. I don't know. I mean, over the course of my life, maybe it's my books.
I was going to say, yeah. I don't want to... I can tend to be chaotic, so please step into
to
structure.
What you do.
but I did want to also say thank you for making time.
My pleasure, man.
For being here, because we've never met, we haven't spoken very much, but you were so open to chatting, and that means a lot.
I love going on podcasts. When we were on Dudesy, I had a thing where I said I'll literally go on anybody's podcast for 20 minutes, and I set up an email that anyone could email, and I would just start booking times every Saturday to go on like different podcasts and
stuff.
That's
so cool.
I find it very fun.
Yeah. I mean, I have to say, I mean, so like I said, I had recognized you from Dudesy, but I didn't put the dots together immediately that you were the same guy in the Necessary Conversation, because the you know, the purpose, the meaning behind it, the tone behind it are so vastly different. I mean, it's like absurdist comedy nonsense into like earnest, you know, political therapy sessions with your family.
Yeah, you know? Dude, it's and I would argue that if you listen to Game of Roses, is my reality show podcast that I do with a friend, that's also drastically different, because we're like hyper focused on the game of reality television, how to become famous in it, how do you leverage like a good play in your rookie season on a feeder show like Bachelor or Survivor into maybe a traitor's invitation, and then how do you leverage that into a million Instagram followers, which can pay you, you know, for the rest of your life basically.
Man, well, since the main thing that in the last few months has really, I mean, just become such an addiction, or such an, maybe the better word is obsession for me, regarding the Necessary Conversation. Like for those who might be listening, who haven't seen clips or, you know, heard the podcast before, maybe you can explain it better. But like, I have such a connection to this because I was born in Mississippi and, spent a lot of years in New Orleans before I moved here. So I have like a very, you know, I have a long history with the South, and with a lot of people who think more or less on the border that you're... I've never really personally met someone who speaks as openly about their feelings as your father does, which is just fascinating. Like, sociological studies, like, should be done about this man. It's fascinating. I wanted to ask, I have so many questions about this podcast.
Please.
I wanted to say that was the big connection because I come from the South. My father is a Trump supporter, very differently though from your father and very differently from your mother. I think my mother tends to be a bit more of the majority of like Southern wives who, you know, mom's listening, but you know, she can be a bit more just accepting of the choices the husband maybe makes or maybe not as actively interested, you know, like just like, oh, well, you know, it's a Republican. So, okay. Mm-hmm. You know, my parents don't have any Trump memorabilia at home. There's no flags, there's no hats. So
then
when I
not
watch
real MAGA.
Yeah. Like when I watch your clips, I mean, it's I've never skipped one because it's so fascinating. The questions are extraordinarily, you know, in depth and earnest. And I have to say before I forget it, because I can be sporadic, I am so inspired and impressed by your patience with your parents.
I get
that's
that
fascinating.
DM a lot.
That's fascinating, yeah. Chad. Where did you come up? Like, when did you decide I'm going to like challenge someone like your dad on these topics?
I mean, I'll give the short history of this podcast of Necessary Conversation. It's you know, I guess somewhere in the middle of Biden is when we started it, because my parents and I have a sister as well. She's also on the podcast.
Yeah.
My sister and I are in our 40s. Our parents are now in their late 60s, early 70s. Parents are MAGA. My sister and I are not. We were not talking to them basically at all since Obama's second term, maybe, is roughly when the real bad schism started happening. We would go back for like Christmases and birthdays and just sit in silence in the living room as like Fox News would be droning on. And it got to a point where I was like, well, they're getting older. Do I really want their lives to end on this kind of no contact basis that my sister and I had with them? And so I just said, no, I don't want that to be the case. So I called my mom up and I said, hey, would you be willing to talk with me and record it for 1 hour, just about like your childhood, your background politically, when you started liking Trump, all that kind of stuff? And I was like, I didn't know if it would work. I didn't know if she'd be down to do it, but she does want to be kind of famous. So I was like, maybe that'll get her. She'll think this is her avenue to that end. But we did that first episode. And then my dad, of course, immediately got jealous. He wanted to do an episode. So that was episode number two. Then I got my sister to do episode number three. And then from that point on, it was all four of us. And those first three episodes, which are audio only, are kind of like they're like personal interviews about the history of each one of us in terms of where we got our political views, what our me and my sister's upbringing was like, what my parents' upbringing was like, where they grew up, all that kind of stuff. The idea for it was that, you know, hopefully by just maintaining an hour a week where they're forced to talk to me and my sister, that it would somehow at least change the relationship, maybe not repair it or whatever, but it would force us to like be in contact with one another on a weekly basis. And that has held true for the whole time. We've been doing this podcast for almost 3 years now, and we talk every week for at least an hour, which is a drastic improvement. Now, my parents, because they're like deep in the MAGA cult, it's hard for them to talk about anything else. So the podcast has to be about politics in order to keep them engaged, I feel like. But a kind of weird byproduct of it that I never anticipated was it kind of drains our political animosity toward one another. It puts it in the podcast. And so when we actually now go back for birthdays and Christmas and stuff, we don't talk about politics at all. We talk about what's going on in each other's lives. We hang out, and it's much more amicable. And I think a better kind of in-person relationship, because we are using this podcast again as a place to kind of almost like suck out all of our political rage and leave it there. I don't know if it's, you know, helping like in any kind of therapeutic way. I'm not a therapist.
But don't you think that it might be like for you personally? I mean, the relationship is more communicative, right?
Absolutely. And the idea that, like, you know, I get tons of DMs from people being like, they're a lost cause, you have to go no contact. I personally think, to each their own, if that's the strategy that works for you, if that's what you have to do for your own mental health, great, so be it. For me, I feel the exact opposite. I feel like you must talk to the people who have these wildly opposed views to you socially, politically, everything, philosophically. Otherwise, if there's nothing in between, if there's no communication in between, the two camps just fester in their own stew of bullshit.
Yeah.
And then they never talk. And that's how we're currently in this position.
Yeah. The echo chambers only reflect and reverberate more and more of the same things they want to hear.
Exactly. And I do also think that there's this idea on both sides that whoever's on that side hates my guts, so I hate them. And if you don't talk, that idea persists.
Yeah.
But I think, and like you're saying, my dad's a wild fucking character, to be sure. But having him like talk to his kids, I think it does do something to him. It softens him a little bit, if you can believe that.
You can see it. There's
every
moments.
Once in a while.
There's moments where you, I mean, it's, you know, if you watch enough episodes, you can see where that small break happens. You won't see it on just one or two clips, but if you've watched it as much as I have, you'll see these little glimpses, like these little, almost like little stars in his eye.
Sure.
I mean, they're subtle. Trust me, they're subtle.
Yeah, you got to know what you're looking for. But like,
there'll be like little things, because you're so patient and you're so understanding, and I'm so inspired by that. It's so amazing to be able to hear things and to be. I mean, when your dad like calls you an asshole and stuff like that, it's a different upbringing for you, and you're a bit older, so maybe it's a different like toughness in your skin than I would have. Sure. But you know, the way you're able to kind of laugh at it or to stay on topic in that moment.
Yeah, I mean, you know, for me, like, this is maybe like a deeper philosophical kind of take on just reality. I don't personally think any of this is real. I don't know what any of this actually is. None of us do. You can say you
like
do,
but life
you don't.
Generally, or
existence. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
What reality as we perceive it.
Right.
It's at this point scientifically almost 100% conclusive that this is not reality, that what we perceive is a kind of mishmash of what our senses can perceive. So it's building a model that can, you know, be sifted basically through our senses and nothing else. Even at that level, it's unreal. But then you start getting into like human consciousness and all the stuff that's being done in quantum mechanics right now and quantum physics.
Do those thoughts give you strength in those what could be emotional conversations?
I don't know if it's strength or not. It may be a strength. It may be a weakness. But in thinking that nothing is real, nothing really bothers me. Because
it's freeing.
I'm just like, I don't, whatever, you know. So I just try to entertain myself, basically. And I view that podcast with my parents. Like, I love my parents and stuff. You know, whether this is real or not, the emotions I feel are real to me. So I have
exactly.
to go
yeah.
on that basis kind of alone, I suppose. But I really view almost every situation in my life as a sitcom. Because I think I grew up watching like the sitcoms of the 80s and 90s, and tonally, comedically, that's just how I see everything. And so when my dad is sitting there calling me a piece of shit asshole, you don't know anything, I'm just seeing him as like a sitcom character yelling at his son, like an Archie Bunker.
All right, Red Fox, Archie Bunker, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And I think for me, the ability to kind of like, I won't say not be present in my own life, but be more of an observer to my own life than a participant, allows me to kind of like get through any situation, no matter what it may be.
Well, dude, it's like such a restructuring. It's like a restructuring of the information you're being given, whether it's from a person very close to you, like a parent. Maybe it's even, you know, evolved into other relationships that are not as personal. But it's really cool how you're able to do that. And I imagine you do get a lot of DMs from men being like, how do you not cry when your dad acts like that? You know,
I mean, I get like DMs from people saying like, you should never talk to them again. He's a horrible piece of shit. You should never platform him and all this kind of stuff. And that argument too, I'm like,
but you're not supporting his ideas. You are simply a son talking to a father whose ideas about a certain topic are very, very vastly different. Maybe you guys have things you do have in common. I'm sure you do. But there's that one topic, and that's the connecting thread in order to get him to sit down and to be present for an hour. And I think you should keep going. Do you think you have an end goal in mind for that podcast?
No, I don't really. I mean, it's become like a...
It's like therapy, right?
Yeah, to some degree. I mean, also, like, I just like creating shit, whether I'm writing books or making paintings or whatever. And I have found that, like, all the people that I'm closest with in my life, I have artistic projects with, podcasts or writing TV shows or whatever. That's kind of... for better or worse, I suppose, it's kind of how I maintain relationships in my own life. It's like, if we're not working on some project together, I'm probably not going to be talking to you as much as the people that I'm working on shit with.
Sure.
And so that is like a part of this for me, I suppose. But yeah, I don't really see an end to it. Like, I don't think the political schism that has happened in America and even globally as a result, I don't think it's will be alleviated in my lifetime. I think that's always going to be there. And so there are always that conversation that we have on that podcast, I think, can happen indefinitely, or at least till the end of my, the mortal coil is shuffled off, you know.
The mortal coil. I love that. Have you gotten these? You must check the comments now and then. Have you seen these conversations being had in the comment sections about that your mom is worth saving? She could be turned, or like she's there. If the dad, you know, were to unfortunately pass away first, she would come around, those kind of conversations. How does that make you feel when you read those messages?
I mean, these are conversations my sister and I have had multiple times, obviously.
Okay.
It's like, I mean, that's not an overt goal of this podcast.
Sure.
But it's like, it's always on the back burner, you know, it's always in my mind that, yes, she might be able to be pulled out of this if the TVs weren't on in the house 24 hours a day, blasting Newsmax in her fucking brain.
Yeah. You know,
if some subtle changes, or I guess not so subtle, if some major components of her daily life were to be removed or replaced, I think my mom would kind of revert to her natural self, which is like just a lady who wants to go ride horses and look at butterflies, you know?
Yeah, dude. I think a lot of moms in the South, honestly, are kind of ignored, even though they would be exactly on that same path. I can't speak, you know, exactly for my mom, but if my dad were to pass first, I've had conversations with her, you know, late in the night, just me and her, just about personal, real things. I live in Europe. There's, you know, societal systems in place that are, well, for the human race, pretty necessary, and that those things aren't offered in the States. And to have these conversations, just to be open about certain rights that are available to us, I get the hint that if that world, that cloud wasn't, you know, like constantly around her, perhaps she wouldn't agree with all of them.
Yeah. And it's like, a lot of people say it's like the boomer generation who didn't understand social media and were, you know, the prime targets kind of psychologically for a Fox News mental brainwashing. But I don't think it's just boomers. The rate at which technology is changing in terms of being able to make media with AI and everything else, every generation, every person is really susceptible to this if it's targeted correctly. And most of these new algorithms that are coming out, certainly with what like Palantir's doing, they are building AI specifically to harvest all of our data, make giant databases, and then look at how that data can be used to shift the scale one way or another. Because in a kind of like large system, if you look at humanity or even the American population as just this large system of data, you're looking at swaying voting blocks by like 5%. That can determine past election. It determines almost every election. It's a very small margin.
Yeah.
So if you can do something, either inserting propaganda into the population, fucking with voting machines, which now it's looking more and more likely, Elon Musk did do that, you can win the election, in quotes, win the election. So I think it's like, we're all susceptible to it, or enough of us are susceptible to it that it can sway a huge presidential election like that.
Yeah.
And I don't think that is going to change. I think it's going to get much worse in the next five. I mean, it's already happening. It's getting worse now.
Yeah. I mean, I was going to ask you, you know, I guess it's going to be a topic pretty soon on your next episode, but you know, what are your personal thoughts, if you don't mind answering, about like, sure, you know, the recent bombings in Iran and how they responded, and in Qatar, and
yeah, it all seems very fake to me. I don't know how else to put it. Like, obviously what's happening in Israel and Iran, that's not fake. They are like launching missiles at each other and trying to kill each other. They're looking for obliteration of the other society. What America did, though, these Trump bombings, he telegraphed it by multiple days. There are now, at least what I'm reading online, again, believe what you want to believe, but I am reading this online, that there were trucks seen leaving all of these sites, very probably carrying the enriched uranium. So it seems very likely that he just blew up three empty buildings. Then he goes on Twitter and claims, success, we obliterated their whole nuclear program. And it's like, but you didn't.
Now's the time for peace.
Yeah, exactly. Now I did it. My peaceful bombs. I think, I don't think that they blew anything up. I don't think that they even needed to. At least, again, this is what I'm reading online. I don't know how to suss out what is true. I know the details I'm getting. The data I'm getting tells me that there were no nuclear weapons. They were not close to getting a nuclear weapon. All of the U.S. intelligence said that was the case. So what are we doing here?
Yeah.
Is this just some kind of like...
I think it's a strategy to distract from... Yeah. Other things they're doing. It's
for
very
sure.
it's yeah. giving very Bush Cheney, you know.
That's what me and my sister. I uploaded a clip this morning that is exactly that. My sister and I talking about, is this WMD's part two, basically? Is it some predicate to start like a forever war in Iran now, so that, you know, in 3 years Trump can be like, well, I'm a wartime president, we can't have an election. You know, I don't know.
Yeah, you never know what the strategy is, especially when people like, you know, Roger Stone is still involved in communication. We saw this image, and Steve Bannon, of course. It's a really crazy thing. I want to ask you one more. It's mildly political, but then we can move on to some other entertainment things just for those who aren't so into politics. But I wanted to ask you about this super viral interview between Tucker Carlson and... the guy,
Ted Cruz.
Thank you. Yes. What did you think about those clips? That was pretty exciting.
Fuck. It was wild. Like Marjorie Taylor Greene kind of has come out and said Fox News is propaganda and stuff. Tucker Carlson flipping on Ted Cruz was wild. I mean, he doesn't give him, at least in the clips I've seen. He doesn't give him a fucking inch. He's just hammering him with like, well, you're fucking wrong about this. And that's not. Like,
You don't know anything about the country you choose to topple.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. You don't know how many people live in the country. And Ted Cruz is like, I don't need to know how many people live in the country.
He's like, 92
before
million.
We should bomb them.
Yeah.
it's unbelievable.
It's fun. It's like, why do you think Tucker Carlson came back around?
I think Tucker Carlson is like unfettered now. When he worked for Fox News, Big Daddy Rupert Murdoch said, this is how you're going to talk about everything.
Right.
It has to be pro-Trump. It has to be this. We are lying to everybody to take their money. Now he's doing his own thing, and he can kind of be like, whatever.
I've got money.
I think,
I've got money now. I can just do what I want. Yeah.
But I think for a lot of like people on the right, there is a pleasure in being a contrarian. In whatever you're saying, fuck you, I say the opposite, and I'm going to win, and you're going to lose. And he's sitting there interviewing a single person. Happens to be Ted Cruz, who is obviously
the biggest loser on the planet.
Sure, if you want to see it that way. But I mean, he's obviously a Republican or Tea Party or whatever.
Yeah,
But he still is sitting down in a one-on-one conversation where he is not, at this point, beholden to a boss telling him, you got to be nice to this guy and prop him up. And so I think his innate kind of troll kicks in, and he's just like, fuck it. I'm going to troll this guy. And that's the whole thing. Like, and it gave us
just
going to
get
quotes.
Mad clicks, dude. They're going to put this on Seth exactly. Meyers, Jimmy Kimmel, John Oliver.
Yeah, exactly. Smart.
I think, in the end of the day, it's probably just a business guy who knows what's going
to
pop off, you know?
To
him challenging
degree,
Ted Cruz, he must have known that was going to be such a banger.
Yeah.
And, you know, and Democrats are eating that shit up like Doritos or like Flamin' Hot Cheetos, like, licking their fingers like, oh, you didn't know that, Teddy?
For real?
Dude, you're so involved with politics, particularly on this podcast with your family. Mm-hmm. But, you know, this is not by far where you started. I wanted to talk a little bit, if you could, you know, maybe give the listeners, particularly people like my mom, who perhaps have never seen your work or your face before, a little intro into like, you know, getting into LA and becoming, you know, what was first with like being an author, and now you're, you know, you've written films and things like that.
Yeah, I, you know, grew up outside Dallas in some suburbs, and then applied to different colleges, got into USC's film school, said I'm going to Los Angeles, and I have never left. And I don't know, I graduated in 1999, kind of kicked around doing assistant jobs and stuff in the entertainment industry, worked for a music magazine for a minute, and then
did you want to write like at that stage, yeah, or did you want to act or direct? Or
no, never wanted to, write and direct primarily is still what I want to do.
Sure.
I remember I had a job at this place that we did like TV commercials for Disney Princess tea parties, DVDs, get them before they go back in the vault, all this shit, just mind numbing. And that job ended, that company folded, and I got laid off, and I had 3 months severance, and I was just like, fuck. I was getting my resume back together to get some other kind of menial job in some other post-production house. And I said at that time, I had like a little bit of interest in some of the things I'd written from some agents and managers and whatever, and I was like, fuck it, I'm not gonna try and get another job. I'm going all in. I'm gonna use these 3 months to sell something. And so I just worked my ass off basically in those 3 months. And I had a lot of material already written. And I don't know if it was luck or manifestation, whatever you want to call it. In those 3 months, I sold my first TV show, movie, and a reality show that would star myself and two of my buddies. And we got to shoot that pilot for VH1, and then they canned it. But nonetheless, it kind of got my foot in the door.
Still,
and
yeah.
And then the TV show I sold wound up going nowhere, but it gave me a little bit of money to kind of like float me for the next couple of months.
Yeah.
And the movie I sold would take 7 years to get made. It was Burt Wonderstone after a million rewrites by other people.
You wrote Burt Wonderstone before you wrote the book for Men, Women, and Children?
Simultaneously.
Wow. Roughly. Okay.
And then Men, Women, way before Men, Women, Children. Yeah, sorry. My first book was called Average American Male. That one was in 2007, I think it came out or something. And at Burt Wonderstone, I wrote it right around that same time. And then I also got a book deal roughly in that same year. But that first year where I sold all that shit, you know, a lot of people were like, oh my God, that's millions of dollars. I came out of that year making about 45 grand for that entire year.
Dude, people do not understand how that business works at all. Like, if you get a green light, you're so still begging for the next green light, you know? Like,
of course. It's always these steps. I've sold probably 20 TV shows to networks, streamers, cable, whatever. I've had one of those make it to series. Maybe five or six go to pilot, which means they make the first episode, and then they evaluate it. And if they like it, they'll order 10 episodes of a series. If they don't, they throw it in the trash. Fuck you very much.
Yeah.
Oh, and that has, you know, paid my bills. And the more you sell, yes, your quote goes up and all this kind of stuff. But if you don't have, in TV anyway, if you don't have a show that's like on the air for 3 seasons minimum, you're just working. It's just a job that is like allowing you to live. You're not rich by any means. And that was kind of like an eye-opening thing for me in Hollywood. to say the least. I'm like, I've sold all this shit. Why am I living in a fucking one-bedroom apartment?
Well, dude, people still don't understand. Like, you know, I went to film school as well, and that's how I met my partner. And like, she's a screenwriter, and I work more like in front of camera entertainment, whatever. But we do a lot of projects together and try and make a lot of comedy stuff together. And a lot of people, what a lot of people don't understand who are not in any connection to the entertainment industry whatsoever. Mm-hmm. What they don't know is that like 99.99% of like television show ideas, movie ideas, any sort of like prompt to get something out fails and it's just dumped in a trash can or withheld with rights through an agency for like 18 months, 3 years, 5 years. Mm-hmm. And you're just like sitting on your ass like, well, what do I do now? You know, they're just like, why don't you just write a good movie? Go to Tom Hanks's house and knock on his door, you know? People just don't get it.
The biggest thing I ever sold was a movie called Dan Mintner, Badass for Hire. And it was a comedy. It was kind of like an Austin Powers treatment of like a Schwarzenegger or Stallone 80s one-man army type guy. And it sold for, at the time, a lot of money. But of course, against a lot more, which means we'll give you this amount of money for the script. And then if we make it, you get all this money.
Right.
And I was like, this is fucking crazy. It was in the trades. Yeah. The Rock was attached to be the guy. They had the guy who would eventually become the director of John Wick was attached for this to be his first movie.
Damn.
It was insane. Never got made. Thrown in the trash. Then it was obviously very like machismo kind of script. And so then I get word after the first Trump election, there was a sensitivity reader And then it got a massive sensitivity rewrite, and they were thinking about making it. And I'm like, oh, Jesus. I never got to read that next version of the script.
You never saw it?
I'm just like, what's that?
You never saw that sensitivity rewrite?
No, nor would I ever be able to. Once you sell a movie and you sign that check, or you sign that contract and you get the check,
yeah,
you don't have any claim to it.
Right, right.
It can be, everything in it can be changed. And so that is what happened. I don't know where it is now. I'm sure it's just dead at the bottom of a drawer somewhere. But
as with so many great things, man. Yeah.
Yeah.
What was your first, like, I know Men, Women, and Children, but you were saying you were writing that around the same time as Burt Wonderstone. What was like, you know, let's talk about books. What was the first book that you'd put out and, you know, you got this feeling for yourself as a creator, like, oh, okay. Now I've done something like this, you know, this boost.
Yeah, probably. I mean, Average American Male was my first book.
And that's right.
I wrote that in response to kind of like, at the time there was a book called He's Just Not That Into You had come out, like 2005, six, something. And everybody was touting it as like, this is exactly how the male mind works. And I read that book and I was like, I don't think that's accurate. So I'm going to write this thing that's kind of like what I perceive to be how a guy thinks about relationships and the world and whatever. Again, roughly 2007, 2008. The character is very misogynistic. And that idea and that kind of tone definitely is completely against my audience for Game of Roses, that podcast, which is primarily like the whole audience is millennial women. So when that podcast started kind of like taking off, there was a whole thing on Reddit where they were like, oh my God, this guy wrote all these horrible, nasty books, and I had to come out and do like an episode where I talked about that. But
how come also people not separate that you're writing, you know, you're not writing an autobiography.
It's 100% fiction.
Yeah, I find that crazy. People can't make those separations sometimes.
I mean, look, dude, don't get me started on reality TV. People pass moralistic judgment on these players in these reality TV shows, and it's like all of that shit is fake.
It's all scripted.
It's 100% pro wrestling. At any rate, that book came out. It did pretty well. It sold like 100,000 copies, I think, in its first year, which is considered pretty successful.
Yeah.
And then I got a couple more book deals after that. But again, that book deal, for that book, it was, I think, $30,000 was the advance, paid out in three installments over the course of a year and a half.
Right.
So it's like people think, oh, he got a book published. And you're like, no, that paid my rent for like 2 months. Dude. You know, each of those installments or whatever.
People don't understand that too. There's like a signing. So you have like your flat rate that you accept, and then you have like a portion of that for the contract signing. Mm-hmm. You have a portion of that for like the first manuscript, and then you have that last portion when the final publish edit is, you know, accepted by the publishing company.
And your agent is taking 15%, your manager's taking 5%. So, you know, you have to like constantly be working. But I do remember like that was a cool day. You get to walk into a bookstore and see a book there with your name on it. And you're like, holy shit, this is happening. And I wound up selling that book as a TV show to Showtime that got fucking destroyed by this other writer they brought in. And then I sold as a movie as well to Fox Atomic, which that company folded and all their projects got destroyed.
Was Fox Atomic like a part of 20th Century Fox?
Yeah, they did like, they only made a couple of movies. One of them was a Rainn Wilson movie where he was like a babysitter or something. I forget even the name of it.
Wait, was that the Jumanji sequel thing? The weird sci-fi? No. Okay.
I wonder. Look it up. Google Fox Atomic. They were like a...
Let me check this out, yeah.
They were meant to be like a Fox Searchlight kind of thing, but for more like... raucous comedy type shit, you know.
Okay. Early 2000s, like Wedding Crashers style.
Yeah, something like that, I think. So
I see. I Love You, Beth Cooper. Jennifer's Body. Right.
There you go. Right. There you go. At any rate, that was the first thing that I sold. And right around that same time, like I said, I sold a sitcom with my good friend Will Sasso. We co-wrote a sitcom called Waiting to Die that we sold to CBS. We got to shoot that pilot. It had TJ Miller in it.
Ooh.
Josh Lawson, Josh Gad was in it. And Sarah Wright, Jillian Bell, had some heavy hitters.
Really heavy hitters. Yeah. Wow.
and all before they were like big stars. And we made this pilot, and it was great, and it was hilarious. And then that season, CBS picked up one show to series called Accidentally on Purpose, starring Jenna Elfman. And it was basically the exact plot of Knocked Up. They just took that plot and turned it into a TV show that I think was canceled before they even aired the full 10-episode season.
Oh, that's so vicious.
And that was it.
That's
so vicious. And then that gets thrown in the trash, and you have to go right back into the same people who threw it in the trash 2 months later, and, hey, guys, no hard feelings. Here's my new idea.
What was the like the project that you know was denied, for example, that or what's something that you've written or participated in that really like connected to your deepest soul, like this is me on paper?
Dude, it was a TV show that I pitched that no one ever bought because I think it was just too I don't know. I'll pitch it to you now. It's called Only Child. Child is spelled C-H-I-L-D-E.
Okay.
And this is also the title of a TV show from the early 2000s, a fictional TV show about, it's a sitcom, about two parents who are both therapists. The mom has the idea that, like, if you're feeling an emotion, you should feel it, express it, let it out. The dad is like, no, if you're feeling something, you should take time, understand it, never express it, analyze it, know why you're doing it, and if it's good, enjoy it. If it's bad, learn how to suppress and remove. They have a child, an only child, if you will, a 10-year-old kid who's just a happy-go-lucky 10-year-old kid who just wants to live his life and have fun. He has a babysitter who's kind of like a slutty next-door neighbor, like a Kelly Bundy type. Mm-hmm. She has a bad boy boyfriend who she's always inviting over when the parents are out to like drink their booze and have premarital sex. Those are the main characters of that sitcom. So that has virtually nothing to do with the pitch. The pitch is this. It's 20 years later, aliens show up and they say, our new emperor loves Only Child. You only made one season of it. We are here to make season two or destroy your planet. And so everybody's like, well, what? All those actors are like 20 years older. And they're like, you fucking idiots. Time doesn't exist. And so these aliens basically have a greater understanding of reality. So they go around. We find out that the guy who played the dad is now serving a life sentence for vehicular or murder, I guess, in the state of California because he got drunk and killed some people drunk driving. They bust him out of jail. The mom hated her experience on Only Child so much that she moved back to Indiana, married her high school sweetheart, and has two kids in the idyllic life. And they say, we're going to kill your whole fucking family unless you come do season two of this show. The babysitter is believes now that she can talk to aliens. She got another role in a show right after that that is basically the exact same. And that show blew up. She has all this money. She thinks she can talk to aliens and is online constantly talking about that. The bad boy boyfriend has become ultra Christian. And he's like, I don't care if you kill the fucking planet. I'm not playing that character again. If you kill me and everybody on it, I'll go to fucking heaven. And they're like, how about this? Click. And they put a collar on him that forces him to behave how they want. And he can kind of fight it, but they can basically like write dialogue and he says it. And the 10-year-old kid is Leonardo DiCaprio, biggest A-list movie star in the world. And the aliens to him are like, we'll let you be a galactic overlord if you come back and do this part. And he's like, sounds cool, dude. And so the show is then you have three kind of components of the show. Clips from the old early 2000s show shot in, you know, three camera sitcom setup style. You have flashbacks to the time from when that show got canceled to where we are now to see how that guy got in jail, why she moved back to Indiana, how he became Leonardo DiCaprio.
Right.
And then you have obviously contemporary footage of what's happening now as these aliens are producing this show every week. And the whole kind of like joke on the aliens is they know time, money, death, love, none of these things are real. But on Earth, they have to contend with them because humanity believes them to be real.
So they have to
at a certain point figure out how to like make money to budget the show. So they have to get jobs, that kind of shit, you know. I loved that idea. I still do. And maybe I'll make it with AI in the next year or so.
I'm sure you could make at least a pilot or something with your connections with just a low budget, you know. I'm sure you could make something. Put it on YouTube with your you know.
It's just going to be me. It's going to be me making it in probably VO3 or VO4 when that comes out in probably 6 months.
I mean, it looks pretty fucking legit on there. I like that idea. I thought at first you were going to say, because my brain always tends to go hyper silly. I thought you were going to say they think this guy is Leo DiCaprio, but they only call him Gilbert Grape, even though that's the brother. They. Like, you're Gilbert Grape, And they want him to play, like, mentally disabled.
Oh, my God. That is one way to go with
this. He's like,
yes.
Guys, no, actually, I was on Broadway. I have a Tony. I have an Oscar. They're like, no, Gilbert Grape. No. Yeah. What was that movie with Tim Allen? Oh, Galaxy Quest.
Yeah, Galaxy Quest.
I was thinking of something like in that world. I love that, man. Yeah. That's really fun. I think we have well, with you having been like longtime friends with Will Sasso, it makes sense that we have silly like sense of humors. I wanted to ask. It might seem a little bit random in this moment, but it connects to something later.
Sure.
I wanted to ask because I don't often get to meet a lot of people who work in the industry, particularly in LA, and my little pocket, you know, laying in bed at night dream is this, strange as it seems, being approached on some sort of red carpet event by Letterboxd and getting that classic question of, what are your four favorite films? And I wanted to ask you, as a writer, particularly, you know, you're established. What are like four favorite films that come to mind?
My favorite movie of all time is The Natural. I don't think that will ever change.
That's so good, yeah.
I love baseball, but beyond that, it's Joseph Campbell's classic hero's journey. All of the elements are there, but told through this incredible baseball story. Robert Redford is at his prime in that movie. The soundtrack. I'm getting chills just thinking about the final home run scene. I love that fucking movie and will till the day I die. Beyond that, you know, it's probably a similar list to a lot of people. You got to put Godfather in there. It's
Godfather.
Like, period.
Okay.
It's
There's
one
no
of the
wrong
best
answer.
Movies ever made. Yeah, of course. I personally also like just my personal tastes. I love Flash Gordon. I know that movie is like kind of shitty, but it has such
no,
crazy
dude,
fucking
it's camp.
History.
It's good camp. You know, it's got its own
but
thing.
I don't know if you followed any of the story or the documentary about Joe Dworsky's Dune.
No. Tell me about it.
This was a dude. He was like a weird kind of surrealist filmmaker, but he had made a couple of movies in Spain, I believe, that were, or Argentina, maybe. I forget where he was from. This is back in the 70s, 60s and 70s. And the U.S. studios were like, fucking A, this guy's amazing. What do you want to do next? And he's like, I want to do Dune. This is, again, back in the 70s. And people are like, okay. He gets the rights to the book. And then he proceeds to put together a team of people, including H.R. Giger, Mobius, all of these giant artists and writers, the dude who wrote Aliens, all these different people. He puts them together to make this art book that is like 600 pages. He makes six of these books, six copies, gives them to the heads of each studio and says, look at this. I want to make a 12-hour movie that translates this book. And they were just like, go fuck yourself, dude. What are you talking about? And it went nowhere. But that team of people that he compiled went on to make so much amazing shit.
Yeah.
Alien, for example. All the people on Alien came from this like pod of people he created.
Yeah.
But so did Flash Gordon. A bunch of people that he put together went and made Flash Gordon. And that movie has this fucking wild history where the main actor, they were like 75% done with the movie. One of their big sets burned down. Everybody had to fucking go on hiatus. In that time, the main actor, the guy who played Flash Gordon, his agent is telling him, you should not go back. Let's get you more money. Hold out. Say I'm not coming back to the production. So he listens to that advice. And Dino De Laurentiis, who produced the movie, is like, fuck you. They shoot the rest of the movie without him, using a stand-in in a blonde wig to like shoot the back of his head, basically, on his dialogue scenes. And they go back through and they ADR his voice in everything with another voice actor so that they can have that voice actor say lines over the back of his head. Unbelievable.
Amazing. Dude.
Has a Queen soundtrack. Like, it's just...
Right, yeah.
I love that movie. I would also put Conan in there. Conan
I think you've really sold Flash Gordon and Conan the Barbarian. We can put those together. We can say Flash and Conan. You know, that's we're closer in age than I am to my father, but he's a big Conan the Barbarian fan, and we listen to that Flash Gordon soundtrack a lot. He's a big Queen fan.
Absolutely. If you've not seen Flash Gordon, like, do yourself a favor. And also, if you smoke weed or indulge in any kind of drugs, indulge in that drug before you watch it. It is, like, visually, I've never seen anything like it. And I, you know what? I'll throw this as my other favorite in there, Tron, for the exact same reason.
I was going to, visually, that makes sense. That makes sense.
There's nothing like it. There never will be. The technique that they had to develop to make that movie, how they shot it, is just like, nobody's ever doing that again.
Yeah.
I love that fucking movie.
I think, you know, I've thought so often when I have these little, you know, a little film school pretentious little bitch on the toilet being like, you know, oh, I just saw, you know, Zendaya get approached by Letterboxd. What would I say if I was approached? And it changes literally every day, but I think it would consistently have at least, it would have one Wes Anderson movie consistently. Mm-hmm. It would have to be, because, you know, I was at the right age at the right time to see something like Royal Tenenbaums or Darjeeling Limited, to see these relationships that are so vulnerable and like really sad kind of, and like them trudging through loss and depression in different ways. Like watching Richie Tenenbaum when he cuts his hair, Elliot Smith plays in the sink, and it's just art, you know? And I've never not cried to that scene, man.
I don't remember what year this was, but it was when I was in film school. Bottle Rocket had just been made. And at USC, they had this class where... you could basically go watch a movie Thursday nights. They would play a movie that was going to open that Friday, and they would have writers, directors, actors from that movie there to answer questions.
Oh, wow.
And I would go, if you were in film school, you could just go in that class whether you were in it or not. I went every Thursday.
Hell yeah.
And I remember for Bottle Rocket, they had Owen Wilson, Luke Wilson, and Wes Anderson were the guests.
Oh, my God.
And I still remember that to this day. I had a conversation with Owen Wilson because he was talking about... He was from Texas, as was I. He came out to LA to go to school, hated it, went back to UT and got his English major or something. And I guess I must have been a freshman because I was like homesick at the time. I was thinking about doing the same thing, and I had a conversation with him about that. But I've always liked Wes Anderson, even like since Bottle Rocket. I was like, fuck, this dude's doing some cool shit. And then Rushmore and Royal Tenenbaums. And now he's gotten into very specific, you know, but
the last few films, style has overtaken the depth of like characters and things like that.
Sure.
Like, you know, you said Rushmore. I think I would say Rushmore, Darjeeling, Steve Zissou, Tenenbaums. Like, these are movies that affect me so personally. So it's always about like a troubled relationship with a father or with a sibling or with a partner. And the more specific that he is, which in those early films he's deeply specific, the more it's so approachable. Even as I was like 15 watching Tenenbaums, and I was like, oh, Richie's in love with her, but they're step siblings. It was so beautiful, man. It was just so deep. To me,
I agree. No, I love himself.
What's a movie that it doesn't matter how big or small it is, what's a movie that if it's on TV you will not skip it?
I have my two. RoboCop, Matrix.
Oh, Matrix. Yeah, that's a good one, yeah.
Matrix holds up, dude. I just rewatched that whole movie maybe a month ago.
And I'm a staunch, still to this day, I'm a staunch supporter of Reloaded. I really genuinely just love Reloaded.
Interesting. Visually, all of those movies are mind-blowing. The story, though, is like, I don't know.
But the first one's obviously like the tightest script ever. Like, the first one's like art. It's perfect. Yeah. I think the second one was just, I just saw it at the right age, probably.
Yeah. Any zombie movie, Night of the Living Dead, I rewatched not that long ago because it was on. It was just on some fucking channel. I don't know. I mean, any 80s comedies, Beverly Hills Cop, shit like that.
Oh,
another 48 Hours, 48 Hours, Golden Child, any of those Eddie Murphy movies, I'm in.
Oh, yeah.
I guess I don't flip through channels that much anymore, though. Does anybody?
Well, you know, I can only speak of that. I wanted to ask that question because I had just visited my parents in the States. Like, we were texting a bit on TikTok, and I just came back from the States. And they are one of the last households that I know of personally. Of course, it's frequent in the States, but one of the only households in my life that I can go to, and it's just like it was when I was a kid. It's just
they got
TV.
Cable still.
There's commercials. a lot of commercials, and then there's like a movie on. It's like, oh, Ocean's 11? That's cool, mm-hmm. you know, or whatever. Or Goodfellas is on at 10:30 at night or whatever. And it does spark this nostalgia in me. But since I've lived in Germany like a decade now, it's just I just don't get those experiences anymore.
Totally. I mean,
I kind of miss some it of my, sometimes.
My fondest like childhood experiences were staying up till 2 a.m. in the summer and just watching whatever was on HBO or you know, watching MTV on repeat incessantly to watch the same TRL again and again and again. I loved that. And I think that there's, you know, whatever, I'm Gen X. I think most of the people who are in Gen X have that same kind of like relationship. I like almost romanticize the blue glow of the TV as the HBO logo is flying over the little model town.
And oh, I think
those experiences are gone. But I also think that there are new experiences on the horizon with media that we can't even fathom yet. They're going to be so much more powerful than any of that kind of like collective viewing type shit. And I don't know what that'll do to the water cooler talk or whatever in terms of like, oh, we're all watching the same show and talking about it. I think largely that's going to pivot to reality TV. You're seeing it now with Love Island. It's like sports in that way. But I don't know what's going to happen when you have like personally tailored media for everyone on the planet, which is coming sooner than we all know. But I kind of like that exists to me in a bygone time, and I leave it there. And yes, I love that experience and those memories, but I don't lament that that is gone, because I think this new era of media where it's just a tidal wave and you can pick out anything you want. It's like, I'm a huge anime fan. The amount and variety of different anime shows that exist now is like fucking beyond wild to me. It's like, it's crazy. Do you want a slice of life? Do you want a fucking shonen demon? Do you want a shonen robot? Do you want a shonen ninja? Do you want a shonen, you know, it's there's so much. And it's the same with TV. Any little thing you might have, any indulgence can be indulged. Yeah. I fucking love it. I absolutely love it.
I think you're totally right. There's like an acceptance to be had about the change, but I think that can go for just about everything in life. If you don't accept the changes that are coming, it's like that Bob Dylan lyric, you know, get out of the way if you can't lend a hand. It's just like, accept how it is, do your best to like support it and just try and like, you know, understand. I wanted to ask also, because I have a handful of shows that in the last, let's say the last year until like currently still airing, shows that have really broken through the noise for me, either on like Apple TV Plus or HBO. I wanted to ask you, are you watching anything right now that you're just like in love with, or things you saw, you know, in the last 2 years or so? Like really modern shows?
The big show, my girlfriend and I got super into this show called The Last Kingdom that's on
The Last Kingdom? I don't know that.
Yeah. It's about Saxons and Vikings or Danes, as they're called in that era, roughly around like 600 AD. So when England was like these disparate kings of different kingdoms were like all trying to coalesce into England at that point. But the Danes were there just fucking ransacking shit, being like, no, fuck you, we're taking that castle. And it's about this guy, a fictional character named Uhtred of Bebbanburg, how he kind of is caught in the middle. He's Saxon by birth, but he gets at a young age stolen by Danes and turned into a slave and taught how to fight and whatever. And it's just like the amount of story that's in every episode, you're just like, wait, what? Oh, fuck, this is happening? Oh, shit. It's like every episode is basically a movie. It's unbelievably good. We love that show.
Does it feel like, could you compare it to something like, is it more like Game of Thrones, or is it a bit more like The Crown?
It's like... did you see Vikings?
I saw clips. I haven't seen the whole show, but I know that vibe.
It's like, in my opinion, a better Vikings. And I know that's sacrilege because many people love Vikings. But it's a little Game of Thrones-y, I guess. I won't say there's no magic in it, but there's not like dragons and zombies and shit, you know? Mm-hmm. So it's not exactly like that. But we love that show. And it's coming out with a new season, I think, next year. They just announced.
That's awesome.
Love that. There's just so much good shit. I mean, fuck.
Did you watch Severance, for example?
Dude, I got a sore point personally with Severance, so I couldn't.
Tell me.
I mean, I have no direct evidence of this, but I pitched an idea very similar to a production company that may or may not have something to do with that show many years ago. And I'm like,
really?
Interesting. Okay. I watched like the first season of it just to be like, am I crazy or was this stolen? And I reached the 50% tipping point where I was like, I'm pretty sure this was stolen in some way.
Wow. So I didn't watch it. I didn't know. Wow.
Yeah. There's that. I mean, shit, there's so much.
The Studio, the Seth Rogen show. Have you seen this?
I haven't seen it. I haven't watched
it. Chad, I think you'd love it. I think you'd adore it.
It's about like Hollywood, right?
It's basically like as real of a depiction you could imagine, or I could imagine, of like an actual studio head. They basically make a fictional version of, like, you know, so Seth Rogen plays a studio head that's kind of like a fictional Universal or, you know, Fox or something like that. Mm-hmm. And he gets to a position, and the only people above him are the money people, which is played by Bryan Cranston, which is really cool because that pressure feels really real. Mm-hmm. And then under him, he's a film nerd like us. He wants to make art. He wants to work with really inspiring creative people like the Greta Gerwigs, the Sofia Coppolas. You know, he wants to like get stuff off the ground. But it's really showing, I think, a pretty cool honesty behind the business, which is like he has to make decisions that he doesn't like.
Sure.
And he looks like an asshole, and he feels like one too.
He plays the CEO of a studio, or the president.
Yeah, I guess it's more like the president, because, yeah, the CEO doesn't sound right. He's more like the guy in charge of the yeses and the noes that uh-huh. It's called Continental Studios. And I feel like it's more like Universal or something. He's in the last yes and no. He has to go to, like, there's great episodes where he has to go to, like, Martin Scorsese, who plays himself.
Yeah.
And give him yeses and noes, which is fascinating. He has to go to Ron Howard, which might be the funniest thing I've ever seen out of Ron Howard. It's unbelievable. He plays himself, but he's faced with a decision that he doesn't like, and he just goes off. What's cool, it's like you have the fanfare of like people who know, oh, this is you know, Zoe Kravitz, this is Adam Brody, or, you know, for whatever, and they play themselves. So it has that Curb Your Enthusiasm feeling where you're on like a Hollywood lot and you're meeting people who kind of play themselves, like Michael Cera or something. But then the fictional storylines kind of clash, and they get so extreme, and they really blow up. And what I like about it, which I think if it wasn't done so well, if it wasn't written so well, by the way, starring Ike Barinholtz, he's like the second lead in there, which is also like a nice connection back to Will. He's been killing it, dude. I love Ike.
Yeah.
I think if the writing wasn't as good, I wouldn't like this style choice. But because the writing is so good, I love it, because it feels so frenetic. But almost every single episode feels, and probably is, mostly just one take. So you have like a 40-minute episode that, sure, there's, you know, sneaky little edits that only people like you and me might see now and then. But the story is so good and the acting is so good, you don't notice it. It just all feels like one very frenetic, chaotic oneer.
Yeah.
It's great.
I'll have to check it out, maybe.
It's very good. I love it.
I'm aware of it. I generally don't, I'm not that into like inside baseball Hollywood shit, usually speaking. So every once in a while something will pop out, and maybe this is one of those things where I'm like, oh,
it can be dry. It can be dry and repetitive, but this feels fresh. This feels very fresh.
Yeah. I'll tell you the thing, this isn't like that new, but my favorite show maybe of all time is The OA. Have you ever seen that on Netflix?
Dude, I've heard so many people like rant and rave about The OA. Why did it stand out to you?
Because it's about all the shit that I find interesting, like what is reality.
Right.
I know she gets kind of into like a multiverse type thing in a lot of her work, which I'm not sure that I go down that path exactly, but it was just a show unlike anything I've ever seen, like bar none. And when
Wachowski,
it got canceled,
right?
What's that?
It was Wachowski, right? One of the Wachowski.
The OA?
Wasn't
no,
it?
It's Britt Marling.
Oh, what's the Wachowski show I'm thinking of? The Eight? Something Eight?
Oh, shit. I don't know.
Another Netflix show. Sorry. I didn't mean to distract you. OA.
No,
okay.
No problem. I have
no idea
what
you're talking
about. But no, I would encourage everybody to watch The OA. When that show, it got canceled prematurely, in my opinion. It ends on a cliffhanger that is like mind-blowing. They canceled it. In the show, this like very specific patterned dance is like a big part of a certain element of the show. When the show was canceled, groups of people showed up outside of Netflix's headquarters in Hollywood doing that dance.
What?
And I was just like, this is fucking wild. Yeah. I love that show. It's a little older, though. That show's maybe 6 or 7 years old, but it's still on Netflix. You can check
it out. Oh, you know what it was? I was thinking of Sense8. Sense8.
Oh, yeah. I remember. I never watched that, but I remember that coming out.
Yeah, I didn't watch it either, but I thought that was the same. I guess the storyline must be completely different, but I thought that connected. But yeah. Okay, the OA. I've heard so many great things about that.
Check it out.
People went crazy for that, right?
Yeah.
Who are some writers, either novelists or screenwriters working right now that you would recommend or suggest? People that you think are doing really good stuff.
I mean, this will probably be the case till I die. Shane Black is, like, I think the best screenwriter of all time.
Shane Black.
I just have never read anything he's written that I didn't absolutely enjoy, especially like when he was in his heyday. Probably his biggest contribution to the overall evolution of movies was Lethal Weapon.
Oh, wow. He
essentially invented the buddy cop comedy.
He wrote The Nice Guys.
Yeah. And directed that.
Or no, oh, my God. The Nice Guys is so underrated.
Yeah.
Wow.
I don't know if he directed that one. He's directed a couple of his own scripts as well. But all the way back, I think his first movie was Monster Squad in the mid to late 80s, which is a great, like, kids versus monsters kind of fun movie. He did Long Kiss Goodnight, which at the time, I think, sold for the most money ever for a screenplay at like $4 million or something. And movie has been, ripped off in one way or another by a million movies after it.
Dude, Kiss Kiss Bang Bang as well. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, he's great. I absolutely love his writing as well. Highly recommend if you can get your hands on one of his scripts. I remember when I went to film school, USC had a big script library, and you could just go in there if you were in film school and read whatever scripts. And
oh, that's so awesome.
Pour over his shit, like just reading his scripts again and again.
What do you as a writer love about how he writes? Like, what draws you to his style?
He, like, you're taught, or at least we were taught, to like not talk to the reader, that a script has to be kind of dry, you know, show just the action and then the dialogue and no. His shit, he's talking to the person reading the script. And I just remember, like, I'd never read anything like it. It engages you as a reader instantaneously. And it really, like, reading his stuff taught me, I think, a very important lesson in screenwriting, which is, like, you have to hook that fucking reader immediately. Maybe this movie will get bought or made. Maybe it won't. But the first step to that is you have to convince somebody to read the whole fucking script. And I was right out of school, for extra money, I would read scripts and write coverage for production companies. And so I read my first 2 or 3 years out of college, I probably read 1,000 scripts, writing coverage on them and stuff. And you get to a point where, like, in the first quarter of a page, you can tell if the script is going to be good or not, or if it's going to hold your interest.
Yes.
And so I really learned from Shane Black, like, that first paragraph, whatever your first two words are in a screenplay, better be fucking good. It better, like, elicit something in the reader that's like, whoa, what's going on here? Or make them laugh. It has to elicit some strong response almost immediately. And his scripts always do that. His description of action is like art. I mean, I've just never read anything like his stuff. He's a fantastic writer. And in terms of, like, novels, probably Isaac Asimov, the Foundation series, I think, is like...
Yes, That's there's the sci-fi just nothing for like the kings.
Yeah, nothing like it. I haven't seen that Apple show. I've heard it's pretty good, but I don't have Apple TV.
I haven't seen it either. I wanted to ask you also about your big Matrix fan. Did you see the Resurrections, the fourth one?
Yeah, I did.
Thoughts?
Shouldn't have been done.
Shouldn't have been done.
No need for that. No need for that one.
Never, dude. It was it was like farting on a piece of toilet paper and getting a little shit on it, and then with a toothpick carving out the word Matrix and being like, here you go. Yeah.
It has, like, some fun moments in it and stuff, but, like, it's hard to... I mean, I also don't think 2 and 3 necessarily should have been made, to be honest.
Sure. But by comparison, like, it's like, goddamn, dude.
It was also just like the budget for it was like not what it should have been. It just looked like low rent. The thing about Matrix that, in my opinion, like, it was every element of filmmaking operating at the highest possible level.
Yeah.
The script was incredible. The special effects were not only incredible, they revolutionized how movies are made. Bullet time was something they created that was then copied and every other fucking movie, TV commercials, whatever.
It's still replicated. It.
The soundtrack, the just every element. It was like, in my opinion, it was the Wachowskis at the height of their game.
Yeah.
And then, you know, with that ultra success comes the ability to executive produce Speed Racer, you know, to kind of do these other things and put their hands here and there, and maybe it distracted them a little. I don't know. But that second movie still looked good. The third movie looked good too, but the story started to kind of fall apart. And then by the time you're doing that fourth one, it's like 10 years have passed or whatever. Your head's not in that project anymore. And you're like, yeah, whatever. We can ship this one out. That's what it felt like to me anyway.
It felt like people just are like Sony. I think it was Sony just being like, okay, well, Keanu's back on top societally from John Wick. You know, it's big success. Let's just reboot whatever we can. Matrix popped off. Let's do that. You know, they might as well have made like a Point Break where he's like surfing at 58 or 60. You know, it's just so it was such a money grab. It really bummed me out. I was getting mad. I was really getting mad at it. And they do the thing where like it's like, oh, I mean, spoilers, whatever. No one's going to watch this movie. But like, you know, he's going through like the background world, and it's like they're just literally playing clips from the first movie. It's like, whose perspective is that from? And you're saying it's a video game? I don't think so. I play video games, and Unreal Engine 5 for Resident Evil doesn't look like that. Also,
I agree.
Where's Lawrence Fishburne? Like, I really hated it.
Yeah.
You know,
you can definitely like taint the legacy of a good franchise or a good movie by trying to reboot it or add one on the end there just to see, you know.
Well, dude, it's like Indiana Jones as well. I think Indiana Jones has also just been slaughtered by its consistent reboots and remakes.
I will never forget one of the worst 2-hour periods of my life. I was hungover severely. I forgot that I had to take my car to get it fixed. So I wake up and I'm like, fuck, my head is pounding. I drive my car. I'm like 20 minutes late. So sorry. They're like, you got to leave your car here now for 3 hours to get this thing. And I'm in Hollywood. There's a movie theater right down the street. I'm like, all right, fuck it. I'll go see what's playing this movie theater. It was the Indiana Jones and the Crystal Skull. And I walked in there. I was the only person in the theater. It had been out for probably a month. Just horribly hungover, trying to like nurse this Dr. Pepper while my car is getting fixed. Just watching God knows what. It
garbage.
Was so bad.
Just garbage. Yeah.
I couldn't believe it got made. I couldn't believe it. And it's weird to me, like having sold movies and gotten some made and stuff. I understand there's a process in place where massive amounts of notes are given. People are brought in, hired to rewrite your shit against your will to try and make the script better, whatever. And that can totally fuck up a script. But in some cases, you see these movies where I think such big names are attached as writers and directors that no notes are given. And it's the exact opposite happens. Like, that's the bad thing. Sometimes you do need to like have somebody look at it and be like, well, I don't know. Should we really have the monkeys attacking them like this? You know? I don't know. That movie just to me seemed like nobody said no to anything.
So he's
going to
survive in a small refrigerator after being launched 175 yards. Like, even if the fridge worked, he's 68 years old. He would be fractured in half.
It's fine.
Like, it's a movie. Yeah.
Everybody knows a refrigerator can survive a nuclear explosion.
Of course.
Everything's fine.
Man, I don't know. I remember like seeing the trailer and just getting disgusted. I know when I was, I'm a little bit less of this now. Depends, I guess, on what I'm passionate about in the moment. But when I was like 15 through 25, I was the most pretentious asshole about what I would and would not watch. You know, I was in the South. I had this awakening as a teenager. So I was like, this is my personality now. And this is all that I can offer to other people, which didn't work out well for girls or friends or otherwise. But but I remember like seeing this trailer for Crystal Skull, and it was in that window. And I remember like really, really being pissed off about it and being like, this looks like garbage. It looks glossy. It looks... You know, we didn't really have the AI thing now, but it looked so glossy and AI and smooth. And then I skipped it. I didn't watch it. And then at school or in college or whatever, a few days later, someone was like, did you see the new Indiana Jones? And I said, no, I don't want to. And they said, dude, but the aliens. And that's when I knew I made the right choice.
But it's like, you can tell the aliens to them was like, but wait a minute, we already did something kind of like this in Raiders of the Lost Ark. Like, a supernatural event does take place in the end there. Ghosts come out of the fucking Ark of the Covenant, right, and melt people's faces. Like, aliens is just that. And it's like, but no, it's not. Dude. No. No, it's not.
I fear God. I don't fear, like, little goofy, like, big-headed, you know, skulls, yeah, crystal skulls.
Yeah.
We can't mention, I don't want to take up too much of your time. I know we can wrap it sure up soon. But this poster here, and speaking of Indiana Jones, it's uh-huh reversed, but it says September 5. This was okay, just up at the Oscars this year with, for Best Screenplay. But I cannot have this in the frame talking to you and mention Indiana Jones without telling you a little bit about my friend Moritz, just as a fun story, if you're down.
Sure.
My friend Moritz, a very good, close friend of mine, is the screenwriter for this movie. So it has Peter Sarsgaard, John Magaro, Leonie Benesch, like a really talented German actress. But he is the biggest Indiana Jones fanatic. I mean, an obsessed person. He has these crazy stories where I think what he said was he recorded on tape the audio of his, like, you know, TV or the VHS or whatever playing the movie. Mm-hmm. So he had, like, the audio of the movie playing and would walk around with, like, the cassette and would listen to the movie, like, over and over and over and over.
That's smart.
It's so cool. It's so cool. Yeah. And now he's an Oscar nominated screenwriter. Like, it's so, like, for this movie, it's really crazy. He's like, you know, long story short, basically he's a good friend and he's been writing for these big shows in Germany for a long time. And he had this passion story. This movie, September 5, is about the terrorist attack in Munich at the Olympics in 1975. I don't know if you remember that. Like, I think it was the Palestinians had held the Israeli athletes hostage.
Yeah, I think that's accurate, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I should know more since I've worked on this. But it's been a while. But yeah, this was a story that had been brewing for him. He'd studied it, like, you know, up and down like crazy. And he wrote this movie that, you know, it is a true story. He worked with real people and he wrote this movie. And I got to, by some miracle, through him, through kindness, just, you know, luck, to work on it as the main job was working what they called an off speaker, which was like I was on set at the studios here. What the director didn't want was he didn't want there to be automated playback for the actors to respond to because there was a lot of walkie-talkie radio and phone call stuff. And he didn't want them to, like, press play and hear, like, da 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 da. Right. So I was there, like, at the set, but, you know, in the back with a walkie, like, two different walkie talkies.
That's cool.
Yeah, it was really cool because I got to, like, you know, in my head, I was like, I got to act with Peter Sarsgaard, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
And then as a gift, because the director was very kind, he kind of, like, he could see how hungry I was for this movie. He gave me the gift of also being like a background extra. Mm-hmm. And that was also fun. You can, like, I can see myself in it and it's just so sweet, you know?
Yeah, it's cool.
I love that, like, for my friend's movie. And yeah, I just, we made this and it was a lot of really, it was hard work and a lot of fun. And then when they finished, suddenly we realized that it was like getting sent to all these, or like, you know, they pitched it to all like Telluride festivals and things like that. Mm-hmm. Dude, then it got Oscar nominated, and my good friend went to the fucking Oscars this year.
Yeah, that's wild.
I was here in Germany. I had a fever of like over 100 degrees.
Oh, shit.
I was super dog sick, and I signed up for this live TV streaming platform for like a trial, and I was under a blanket, shirtless, flop sweat. So sick and sweaty. And I had the computer here, and I was watching Conan. Uh-huh. And I was like, oh my God, he's watching Conan O'Brien. That's our hero, you know?
Yeah.
And then I was like in and out of consciousness. And then Amy Poehler came out. And dude, they didn't win, but it's just like, man, having, like, it's just so much fun to, like, totally have a good friend who deserves, like, their accolades and, like, to see the videos. And then they call you like, dude, it's so crazy. The director just got a phone call from Steven Spielberg, you know? And it's like you're living it with them. I just there must have been so many moments also like in your career where you have these like childhood things of like wanting to work in film and wanting to be in entertainment where you must have just been fluttered and shocked. But I thought you'd like that story.
Yeah. No, dude, totally. If you're out here long enough, you get to work with or meet certain people or even become friends with them to some degree. Probably the funniest moment to me that I've ever had, I had a meeting once with this actor, Ryan Phillippe. I don't know if
Oh, yeah, of course.
And it was just like a general meeting. He had read something that I wrote that he liked and whatever. You take a million general meetings that lead to nothing. This was one of those. But this was right at the time that him and Reese Witherspoon were going through their divorce and all this shit. So paparazzi were everywhere. It was on the cover of every tabloid. We have this meeting in some, you know, office building, whatever. And we're walking out together. We're in the lobby and I'm not registering like what's going on. But he goes, "All right, man, good to meet you." Puts on sunglasses, pulls down a baseball cap over his head. And I kind of walk out the front door with him at the same time. There's just a wall of paparazzi. Ryan. And I'm like, "Oh my God, what the fuck?" It was so bizarre. I've never had any, or you know what? I had one other experience like that. One of my books got turned into a movie.
I wanted to talk about that. Men, Women, and Children, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah,
Jason Reitman directed it. And Ansel Elgort was in it, among other actors.
Oh, but I got huge stars in that movie.
And for sure, at the time, he was like a real teen heartthrob. And I got to go to the Toronto Film Festival, which is where it premiered. And as I'm walking in into the screening of it, it's like a red carpet thing. I'm two steps behind Ansel Elgort. And so it wasn't directed at me, but I was close enough to the proximity of the focus of a screaming crowd of maybe 500 14-year-old girls at Ansel Elgort. And he's like, "Hey, what's up?" You know, doing his whatever. And I'm standing like close enough to it that I can kind of feel what that would have been like, you know, to actually be the focus of it. It was wild. Every once in a while, you have some kind of weird moment like that as a writer, but they are few and far between, I would say, as a writer.
Sure, yeah.
Generally speaking, nobody gives a fuck about the writer, even knows who the hell it is.
Sure, yeah.
Once in a while, you get to, by proximity, kind of experience what that might be like.
Oh, man, even like watching, I think there was this footage today that came out where Brad Pitt like interacted with Tom Cruise at this festival or something, and there was this strange like unedited clip maybe from someone's phone of like Pitt coming out of the building and meeting Tom, and the consistent flash of the hundreds of cameras is so jarring. It's so shocking. I don't know how people can just stroll through. I mean, you know, Pitt and Cruise have been doing it for like 40 years, but like I don't know how people stroll through it. I was invited to a singular event at the Berlinale, like the Berlin Film Festival, last year. And it just happened to be for the, like the American embassy. So it was like Film Fest meets like, you know, expats, blah, blah, blah. And I was there and it was significantly smaller, obviously, but it was still like three or four people at this like miniature red carpet thing, sort of telling me, "Hey, look this way," or like, "Hey, Jordan, hey, over here," or whatever. And I'm talking, this was like 2 seconds as opposed to what these guys, you know, what other people go through. But even that, even the smallest little most insignificant casual thing, I smiled and I walked through it, but I felt so much pressure in my chest. Like that was how I feel from that. How the hell to do any I don't know. Have you seen this footage recently of like Bieber clapping back at the paparazzi at the beach house?
Yes, I have.
"You're not clocking it, man. I'm standing on business."
That's so funny. I will say this to all the celebrities who are up and coming. I think paparazzi are going to be gone within 10 years. I think they will be replaced with micro drones, basically, that just are ever present at all times, everywhere. Everything will be recorded.
It makes sense, actually. Yeah.
And they're, you know, for better or worse, I suppose. I'm kind of down with the idea of perpetual recording of everything that happens in public spaces.
Like in The Circle, that book, The Circle?
I never read it. I don't.
Oh, it's a great book. You'd love that. Don't watch the movie. The movie's bad, but the book is very, very good.
All right.
It's good sci-fi. You'll love that.
Yeah. But I think that's like where all this shit is headed. Everything will be recorded constantly and uploaded to a publicly searchable database, probably searchable by location, time, things of those natures. So it'll be very hard to commit public crimes without being caught immediately. And I believe you'll probably have like blackout zones in police, politicians, people who are doing nefarious activity, basically.
Sure, sure. Like speaking of that kind of technology, there's a very funny story, and then I can leave you with this. I know I've taken a lot of your time, but this is a funny story. So I, a few years ago, was invited to the Munich Documentary Film Festival, and I went to a certain premiere because it was a documentary that not only dealt in an interesting crime narrative, but it was mostly in English, and it dealt with like different cities across the globe. And I thought that works for me. So I went, and the overarching narrative was basically following police departments from, let's say, like Chicago, Detroit, you know, Houston. Mm-hmm. And then it was like Amsterdam, Germany, Spain, something else. So a few different places like in Europe and the States. And they were trying to figure out why... like future detecting crime technology, like in Minority Report, like why their algorithms do or don't work, or like why some things, like how that affects the community, like does it work, and like is it unbiased, things like that, which clearly it wasn't. But there was like a lot of stuff where the really funny thing to me and to a lot of people in the theater was they started off this thing about the technology, the crime prediction technology, by going to these different cities in the States. And they basically, it seems like they interviewed these, you know, sheriffs or like, you know, lead detectives, homicide detectives, about what crimes they deal with most in their cities. So you have people coming in like with cigars, like Chicago, being like, we got, you know, 16 raped girls last month. We got this lady who is her armpit was ripped off and tossed in the river. And then they go to like Detroit, and it's like, yeah, we had little boys. They were like, you know, sawed up into pieces, horrible stuff, like horrible. Mm-hmm. You're like, oh my God, this is insane. And then after one more or so, they get to Munich, specifically Munich. And they ask these two police officers in Munich, you know, off camera, like, what are some crimes you're dealing with most? And these two Munich cops in English said, well, you know, we are here near the student center because we are getting calls that a lot of bicycles are being stolen here. Dude, and the whole audience was like, what? Everyone lost their mind.
That's fucking hilarious. Well, hopefully that new AI technology can stop the bicycle thieves.
Yeah, God forbid. Dude, thank you. I'm so grateful for your time and for...
Please, man. It's my pleasure.
This was so much fun. I've put like as many links as I assumed would be the right links into the show description notes. But is there anything that you're working on you want to promote? Any shows? Any upcoming things? Any links? Anything you want to push out?
Just all the podcasts, Necessary Conversation, Game of Roses. Those are the two big ones that I'm doing right now, and right, I'll probably have this next book done. I'm hoping in a month, and then I'll see if anybody wants to publish it.
What's the can I ask anything about what the book's about? Or you want to wait?
Yeah. It's called Future So Bright. It is about a guy dating 30 years in the future when all of American society is run by artificial intelligence. And he rails against it. He refuses to use AI. But you're living in a world where that's a very hard thing to do.
I like that.
Yeah.
We can wrap up here on the official recording. Then I'll just talk to you for a bit off the mic here.
Should I stop my thing?
Let's just say goodbye here real quick, and then we can stop it. But yeah, Chad, thank you so much, guys. Check out The Necessary Conversation. Check out Game of Roses, Dudezy. Go see his movies. Go read his books. Thank you so much for being here. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Look out, baby. The Saints are coming through. And it's all over.
Artsy Fartsy Immigrants, ein Podcast von John Prinz und Moritz Batscheider, produziert für M94.5.